what question do you need to know the answer to where you believe that answer will also help other people?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Tom Morgan. Tom is a director at Sapient Capital. Tom and I discuss curiosity, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, Brett Anderson's work in the movement of reality towards complexity, the question of what is value, and more. Please enjoy. So you started out in finance, and then you, I imagine, had some event in your life where you said, this isn't working for me, I need to go explore other fields, but maybe didn't have a compass yet as to what was the right, or maybe the compass did require you to jump around for a little while before you figured it out. But what was the impetus for making the move out of finance to begin with?
It's almost a cliche, which is maybe why it's applicable to other people, hopefully, which is that I was exceptionally financially, professionally comfortable, had a nice big title, was in a very benign corporate environment full of very nice people. It wasn't what you would have thought Wall Street was on paper at the time, but there simply wasn't enough to stimulate me. And I think part of that was that my interests had kind of diverged with what my day job was. And I was hanging on because I didn't really know what to do next. And then my health started deteriorating. I started getting brain fog and unexplained, like, neurological pains. And then I went through the whole US healthcare system, and I started becoming, I think, like a legitimate hypochondriac, where every time I got a voicemail, I would freak out because I'd be like, oh, that's the test results that tell me I have cancer, right? Like, I'm dying, right? And I would have all of these unexplained ailments. And eventually I went to a functional medicine doctor, and the functional medicine doctor was like, cut everything out. Booze, you know, everything of anything that's any fun at all, stop it. And I started getting more and more energy. And I honestly think all it was just basically distractions had been stripped away, and numbing agents had been stripped away. And then I wrote a book. You can't really describe it as a book, but basically what it was just a collection of resonant quotes, like all the stuff that I'd be reading that had really stuck with me. I put it all into like a 60-page PDF. And then I sent it to my best friend. And my best friend was like, this is just a collection of quotes. This isn't actually a book, right? Like, where are you in this? And then one day I put the finishing touch on the book, and I suddenly had this moment, which is that, like, oh my God, the hero's journey is an instruction manual, not a story. I know what the DAO is, like T-A-O. And I had at that moment what could variously be called a psychotic break or a spiritual awakening. A very, very wild experience, still the strangest thing that's ever happened to me. I now, in retrospect, think that it's actually quite neurologically explicable. But basically, that individual event was sort of a rebellion, I think, by my unconscious to be like, all right, enough of this now, we're moving on. A couple of months later, I quit my job, and I kind of felt that things would be so great and I would be guided by the universe, and that was decisively not the case. And so that process, as you alluded to, was kind of this unbelievably agonizing period of trying to work out, like, what to actually do next.
And then if you feel like you have reached a, I shouldn't say a conclusion, because things are ever evolving, but if you reached a point where you did gain a little bit more clarity, what was that, and kind of where do you sit today with that uncertainty, that agonizing anxiety that you had developed?
Yeah, I think the model is quite straightforward. I think living it is almost impossible and can literally kill you if you don't do it right. Like, it nearly did me. Which is basically, like, I had a skill set in finance that I developed. It was kind of what I was always good at, and I've lent into it in finance. And it didn't really make me very good at finance, but it meant that I enjoyed it a lot. And that was basically going through a huge amount of material and trying to extract stuff that would resonate with people. So, like, in finance, in equity sales, which I used to do, you have like 50 research reports a day. And so you would skim read them all and be like, this is what clients care about. This is what clients care about. And you'd only find out because you were constantly getting feedback from clients who hated you because you were wasting all their time, to be like, Tom, this is a waste of my time. Never call me again. And so you had this incredibly accelerated boot camp where you were like, this is how to get people's attention. This is how to respect people's attention. These are the kind of insights that are really valuable. And then basically all of those skills were deployed towards something that wasn't particularly useful. Indeed, over the time that I was in finance, the marginal value of that information got less and less, and the level of interest in it got less and less. And then I made just a monster mistake of many, one of many, but this was a huge one, which was like, all right, finance is useless. It's completely meaningless. All the skills that I've acquired in finance are not transferable. I need to completely reinvent myself as a hospice worker, even though I get no intrinsic enjoyment from it whatsoever. I need to go and be a social worker. And I remember reading social work textbooks at Fordham, and I would, you know, rather pull out my wisdom teeth with a pair of pliers than read those books. They were so awful and so not interesting me on any level. But I was like, I need to sacrifice myself for a meaningful life. And then what happened was, is I ended up getting temporarily, like, I don't think you ever get it permanently right, but I ended up balancing the two sides. Whereas like, okay, I really enjoy this exercise, but the information I'm providing people is not useful, right? And then on the other side, I was like, can I use these skills of respecting people's attention and showing them interesting insights, but the actual stuff that I'm showing them is really interesting and is actually really going to help them, right? And what's really crazy is that I'm borderline obsessed with Joseph Campbell, and he writes this thing where if you follow your bliss, doors will open where only there were walls. And during my spiritual crisis, I wrote lots of terrible stuff about kind of spirituality, something I didn't really know anything about and was kind of trying to find my own way. And it always fell flat. And then when I wrote one piece synthesizing what I knew about finance with this, the kind of more pretentious spiritual stuff that I cared about, my current employers, like, kind of out of nowhere called me and were like, we will invent a job for you that exactly matches your skills and allows you to follow your dreams and curiosity. So it was this like wild instantiation of this worldview where like I did something that I didn't think was going to be intrinsically useful, which was just writing something I was obsessed with writing. And then the universe, to coin a less annoying phrase, which basically is like, boom, there you go. You finally did what you were supposed to be doing. And here it is. And it's just been a constant process of leading into that, which I don't think I always get right. And I think my communication sucks at times. And anything I've written, if I read it even 2 weeks later, I hate it. Like, I hate listening back to podcasts. But it's this constant process of like, how do I balance that skill set with what the world is asking me to do?
In hindsight, do you think you had to explore these other paths to find out that they weren't the right ones in order to get where you are currently? Or if you had been listening more intently to whatever that gut feeling was about what you should be doing next, you maybe would have gotten to this point sooner.
Man, that's like the most interesting question I can't answer. But when I think about it constantly, which is that, all right, so there's this model that I've been kind of introduced to by this guy, Brett Anderson, who I think is doing remarkable work. And it's basically this unbelievably simple idea where you're existing in a kind of stasis where you have the nagging sense that something's not quite right. And this is mirrored in all the hero's journey archetypes, right? You have Neo sitting as his cubicle monkey where he has this gnawing feeling that something's not quite right. And he gets a clue, you know, the message on the computer, follow the white rabbit from Trinity. He follows it. He's like, ah, that sounds kind of ridiculous, rejects the call, and then gets forced into a crisis by being captured by the agents that shows he has to then still voluntarily cross the threshold and take the red or blue pill, right? And then he goes into this long conflict period against the forces of society that are holding him back, right? But the question is like, that crisis is usually caused by being contacted by an anomaly. As in, you have this worldview, you know it's not right, and then you encounter something that blows your worldview up. For me, it was this psychotic break, spiritual awakening, where I was like, all of my perception of the world is actually wildly incomplete. And it took me years to integrate that. But I think the question that you're asking and that is sort of amazing to contemplate is that, like, if you're a structurally open-minded person, right, and that the moment these anomalies show up, you can just integrate them into your psyche really quickly and correctly, because otherwise you end up believing just a bunch of crazy shit, right? Like, if you can be structurally open-minded and discerning about the right thing, do you ever need to go into crisis because you're just so adaptable you can always kind of go with the flow? Or is there this, like, overly ridiculous, heroic process of agonizing individuation that everyone needs to go through? I think there's a lot of different like ways you can tackle the idea, but I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer either. I would say effectively effectively we'll never know, because the only way we find out is by having the experience itself, and we never know the crises we might have avoided. So maybe it's not worth poking at. I want to dig in more to Brett Anderson's theory, but first I want to touch a little bit more on your obsession with Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. To a point you made earlier, you said something to the effect of most of us look at kind of a story, but it's really a map. There's something highly practical in it to be pulled out and applied to our own lives. What are either the like constituent elements or kind of the theme across the entire journey that you feel like is critically important to apply to our own lives, but maybe folks are overlooking?
Yeah, I you know, like it's the thing we were talking about up front, which is curiosity, right? Which is that if you're in stasis, you will lose interest in what you're doing, right? And the challenge will become a grind, if indeed it was ever a challenge, right? Like we kind of celebrate the grind set in our culture, and it prevents us from understanding that the master currency is, are you interested in what you're doing? And like me in finance, right? I loved it. I loved it for a decade. It was a great run, right? And then just eventually I just stopped caring. But I was in midlife. So I had all of these, you know, requirements. I had a young son. I now have a daughter as well. Like, you know, you're hitting quote unquote your peak earning years, and yet you're suddenly like, ah, oh, shit, I don't care anymore, right? And maybe some people can fill that void with enough outside of work. I don't think work has to be the answer, but I think some people, but I think kind of all people, are called to do something greater, and that call is sort of the call to adventure. And you know when you get it because something mysterious comes into your life, often like quite shockingly with me, or sometimes just someone says something that sticks in your head, right? And you're like, huh, I can't stop thinking about that. And I don't really know why I can't stop thinking about it, but I know I want to learn more about it. And actually there was this moment for me, it was sort of around the same time that I went nuts. I was listening to a podcast with Jordan Peterson, and he was talking about Carl Jung. And he basically said Jung had this idea which your future self calls to you in the present through what you're interested in. And I remember being in like Newark security line, and I was like, wow, okay, Jesus, right. Like, and I just like, I got chills, and I was like, oh my God, that's an idea. And it's been the idea that's ended up changing my life, because it's sort of this idea that there'll be lots of obstacles blocking you from the pursuit of your curiosity, whether it's your physical constraints, but I think also it's a lot of mental constraints. It's the belief that if we end up pursuing our curiosity, we're going to lose any of our intrinsic value because we have no intrinsic value. And there's often a very significant part of us that says we're valueless outside of personas and structures. And I'm not even sure that like our culture is set up to value people out of those structures, right? This is like this is not a dreamy follow your bliss style situation, although I think that's one of the most misinterpreted phrases there is. This is like, wow, going on this journey is really, really, really hard. But if you don't follow your curiosity, you're certainly going to die. You're just going to die spiritually at your desk. And I saw people take their own lives, and I saw people literally die, you know, like well before their time as a result of being unwilling to answer the call to adventure. They just get consumed by the worst parts of themselves, or they end up numbing it out. And that's why I was compelled to leave. And that's why I've been compelled to talk about this ever since, because I'm not sugarcoating how hard the transition is. But me being like, at least for now, on the other side of that transition, I'm so inexpressibly happy and content with my life that I just want to tell people that there is something on the other side of that journey.
This reminds me of a quote in one of your pieces where you said the transformational simplicity beyond complexity rather than the complacency of simplicity before complexity. This idea that through openness, through curiosity, through this pursuit of wisdom, there's this appearance of complexity and uncertainty, but on the other side, you find the simplicity. You touched on maybe society and cultural norms as a blocker to that pursuit. Would you say that's the primary thing, or is it something maybe more intrinsic or internal? Like, just, I mean, it ultimately always comes back to fear. But is fear the culprit? Is there a lack of desire? How do we get more people to realize that through the pursuit of curiosity is where you find this kind of vibrant life worth living?
Yeah, I think I'll answer the second question first, which is that for me, the roots of spirituality can only lead back through science, right? Any attempt to jettison science and the massive amounts of progress that it's given us is just dumb and it's not going to happen, right? Like, I can't see us like discarding all of that and being like, so guys, we're going to go back to some sort of new religion that I just created or something from 2000 years ago. If that was going to happen, it would have happened. And I think that what we've got next is this opportunity that is currently unfolding. All these brilliant people that we can talk about who are like, actually, there is a science of meaning. There is a science of meaning, which is science, cutting edge science is currently proving how consequential we are and how our relationship with the cosmos is significant. And for me, a huge part of that is showing people that in wildly scientifically provable ways, following your curiosity is a good bet. It's a good strategy, right? Like the universe, quote unquote, will reward you with that. Part of the problem is, as you can tell from me using annoying words like the universe, we don't have the language for this yet, but hopefully we're developing it. But if I can just show people that, like, guys, there's actually a scientific side to this, that might help. And I think to answer the first question, I always think of the concept of fitness landscapes, which for the sake of any listeners, this is now a visual metaphor, therefore entirely useless to you. But if you imagine a landscape of rolling hills and peaks, any organism is trying to get to the highest peak. But what happens is it'll get to a slightly lower peak and then it'll sit there just looping. And anything that doesn't evolve out of that peak dies, right? And so you have to go down into a valley in order to go back upwards to find a higher peak. And I think what happens is that people can get stuck on very steep peaks of their own, which is that basically they'll get to this very steep peak where they'll be like earning $500,000 a year and they'll live in Manhattan. And the amount of sacrifice that they have to give up to go back down that peak is so steep, they won't do it. And the same, this dynamic is true in nature, where if you're in a rainforest, then you try and evolve some funky new mechanism, you'll just get eaten immediately. Because you're in a rainforest, it's hyper competitive. But if you live in New Zealand or Maui, it's such an uncompetitive environment, you can try all these different evolutions and end up with a very diverse ecosystem, right? So I think one of it's where you live and what your situation is. And another big part of it is the whatever you're carrying within you, the expectations from your family, the expectations from your parents, whatever kind of trauma prevents you from connecting with your curiosity. I think it's very difficult to connect with your curiosity until you know who you are. I think that process really hurt me a lot. And I think it's really hard to connect with the curiosity until you believe that you actually have gifts. Like, curiosity is about you doing something. It's a process. It's an act. It's about you asking questions and then sort of creating answers. And a lot of people have this voice in their head saying, well, I'm not curious about anything. At least not curious enough about something to blow up my life. And even if I was, then what would I do that would create value? And being unable to answer those questions keeps a lot of people stuck at those peaks. But anything at that peak dies.
This reminds me of in computer science, there's the hill climbing problem, which is effectively the same. You get caught at a local maxima. It's that meets evolution. And it's I think I just tweeted about this the other day as well. So it's something that's been on my mind. There's a few different directions we could go from here. I think I want to cut a layer deeper on Brett Anderson's theory. And I'm going to pose a very challenging task to you first, which is to attempt to summarize his work. I'll link to it in the show notes. But if you could explain what it is at a high level, and why you think that this science of meaning, you've already touched on why you think it's important. But maybe why it resonated with you personally and why you think it's something that is going to resonate with more people once it's more broadly understood.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say is that, you know, I went on a podcast with Brett and Jim O'Shaughnessy where we tried to do justice to this in an hour and a half and still failed. And Brett's currently doing a YouTube lecture series where he's breaking it up into God knows how many hour-long components. So I'd steer people there. And it's one of those annoying situations where you're like, I want to be able to compress this, but some of it is quite hard to do from scratch. I guess if I was going to do it, I'll probably botch this, but it's the hero's journey is the most popular story of all time. That's what Joseph Campbell found. And it follows this highly predictable structure And we've seen it a million times because it's 11 of the 50 highest grossing movies of all time, right? It's Star Wars, it's The Matrix, it's Interstellar, it's Avatar. And I believe that the success of a story directly corresponds to the degree of the evolutionarily important information that it communicates, right? Brett's work really cemented to me the fact that the hero's journey is an explanation of how all transitions happen. So those transitions happen moment to moment in our cognition. They happen in nature and physics, and then they happen at a kind of macro scale across our entire life and also within the evolution of all things. And so like, right, what does this mean on a kind of tangible level? Is that you, to go back to sort of the Matrix example, you're stuck in stasis, as in there is something not quite right with the world. You encounter an anomaly, usually driven by your own curiosity. That then plunges you into chaos, which in the case of the Matrix is this lack of individuation, that he meets Agent Smith, this man with a very generic name that represents competition and zero-sum outcomes. He then integrates that part into himself, as well as integrating the anomaly that tipped him over, and emerges at a higher level of complexity. So basically, he takes whatever blows up the model and overcomes whatever was blocking him from taking up the anomaly and puts it together in a more complex form. So what that does is it makes his map of the world better. It makes his ability to navigate the world better because he can see the map better, and his life just goes better. So like, yes, he's the ideal hero is in a constant state of dissonance, because this is just a process that goes over and over and over again, where you notice something's wrong with the world, you update your model based on external information, your model gets a little bit better, and so on and so on and so on. And the hero ideal is someone that can just do this all the time. They're just constantly in the state of making their model of the world better. And as their model of the world gets better, they get more efficient at navigating it. And that's what we know as a sage or a wise person, which is someone that can get the maximum amount of output for the minimum amount of effort. So you realize all these stories are actually just trying to communicate something that we now believe is scientifically true, but it's also giving you an instruction manual, right? It's also showing you how to do this in your own life. So it's one of those rare situations where you have like, here's this like esoteric scientific concept. It's like, yes, but here's how you actually do it. And here's how you know when it's subject to you. And here's how you know you're going to get out of it. So like, I've just found that an incredibly compelling idea, because it goes back to what I'm saying, is that if any science of meaning has to go back through science, otherwise it's not going to work.
If I was to boil it down into like a single phrase, it's that like meaning comes from this movement towards complexity. And there's a lot buried within that, obviously. It's open to interpretation. But that phrase is kind of synonymous with the trite wisdom of focusing on the journey over the destination. But it's a radical shift to move from thinking in terms of definitive points in time, achievements, attaining things, rather than the process itself. Would you say that's a fair, I mean, I'm oversimplifying this, but if for the purpose of the conversation we did that, is the focus on the process really what this comes down to?
Yes, it's life lived as a process. It's why everyone gets so excited about Infinite Games, the book, right? Kevin Kelly, I think, called it his on-ramp to spirituality, right? Like any goal-oriented outcome is just a really, really bad idea unless you're utterly convinced that that's the right goal and you know where to go after you've achieved that goal. Or the pursuit of that goal is intrinsically enjoyable, which is sort of what we're talking about. I think it's really important to define complexity in this conversation, because it took me a long time to understand what that was. A complex thing, as opposed to a complicated thing, has highly, highly individuated parts that work together in a seamless whole, right? So it's like it's almost like a paradox, right? But what that makes you realize, right? Like, so let's make this tangible. Let's apply it to my own story, right? So what it seems that the world wanted from me was for me to become the maximal version of me, right? Where I have these things that I'm good at, and the more I pursue those completely in pursuit of a positive sum game. So I'm getting slowly better at the stuff that I'm good at, right? And as I get better at it, I can help more and more people. but I really enjoy it and other people really benefit from it. And you can't neglect either of those sides, but that makes everything more complex because the ideal state would be where you have 8 billion people who have all become incredibly unique based on pursuing their intrinsic interests and using their intrinsic gifts, who are all working together in this incredibly complex whole. And that's what evolution appears to be trending towards. So it's like, well, of course you're going to get rewarded for it, and often in very weird and surprising and synchronistic ways, right? Like, but that's what evolution wants from you. And so it kind of frees you up to be like, okay, I really care about this topic and no one else cares at all. Am I doing the right thing? And you're like, yeah, you are. That's actually kind of the best thing. Where it's like, wow, there's this real edge case where I'm really good at one certain thing. And I'm really driven by one certain thing. But that thing also has to be rewarded by the network, right? That's what, I think that's one thing people miss, right? That's why following your bliss is such a misinterpreted phrase. It doesn't mean just do what you want. It means do what you want and the system is providing value for. That's obviously a really loaded phrase and something we can talk about, but I think that understanding of complexity has really helped me like make it more tangible.
Yeah, let's talk about value. What does the system deem valuable?
Oh man, like this is the thing this is the question right now for me. The question. So like, there's this really interesting idea that I'm playing with at the moment, and I'm not sure I've got right, but it's like, if you look at all great scientific breakthroughs, it was typically someone struggled for a really long period of time thinking about something, and then they just whoosh got a download from like the ether, which is something else we could talk about, which is a weird direction I've gone in, right? But they just get this download from somewhere, right? And then that adds value to the whole world. Like, oh, I just invented penicillin. You're welcome, everyone, right? Like, that's literally how it all seems to happen. It's hard work plus inspiration, right? And so I was explaining this to someone, and they were like, you do realize that's kind of what crypto is. And I was like, whoa. And I don't know the first thing about crypto, but you know, it's like you have this really powerful CPU, you put it to generate these mathematical puzzles, and then suddenly it will solve the puzzle and value will be created to the whole network in the form of proof of work, right? But the thing about crypto is one, it's a closed system, and two, it's just generating money, right? Which I think is a little bit nihilistic. I'm just going to get the Bitcoin pros on my back now, but like, it's a very elegant proof of this idea. Whereas we operate in an open system where that value can be distributed to like everyone immediately. Like it's just unbelievably awesome idea that if you decide to dedicate your life to thinking about something that you're intrinsically curious about, but where the answer will help lots of other people, you think that's like you dedicating your computer to like a really valuable thing, and you will produce value if you manage to solve that problem. The problem that I'm wrestling with is that, like, will anyone care, right? Like, will you get paid for that? And this is the big problem, I think, in our society, which is that, yes, I want to encourage people to follow their bliss, right? And yes, I do believe you get rewarded for that in mysterious and intangible ways, right? Like, I had someone call me up out of the blue and be like, would you like your dream job? But I'm at N of one. And anyone listening to my story is like, yeah, dude, it worked out for you, but that means literally nothing. That means literally nothing. Like, do you even know what survivorship bonus is? And like, I have like a whole array of anecdotes of people who live their lives this way and everything kind of worked out. But it's, I still think about people that are producing what I deem to be incredibly valuable work and are receiving no monetary value for it whatsoever, like the creators on the internet. And it slowly seems to be tipping. But I think that if we're gonna be able to help anyone in society, we have to have a mechanism to help people run these experiments. And American culture, uniquely in the world, is set up to dissuade those experiments incredibly aggressively with health insurance, complete absence of any support whatsoever if people are unemployed, a social stigma based on unemployment and expiration, that if you're unsuccessful, it's because it's your fault. I experienced all of these things through my transition. And they hurt. They hurt really, really badly. You know, what do you do for a living? I don't really know. I'm kind of figuring it out. And I think our society has a window of tolerance for men figuring it out of about 3 weeks to 3 months. And most of these expiration periods take about 3 years in my experience. And there's no safety net of any kind. And so the thing I'm struggling with at the moment is, where is the value creation for people creating value? Or if you haven't worked out what your value is yet, and I think that's totally fine, how much rope do you have? right? And how deep is the abyss beneath you? And like, if I was a much weirder person than I am, no, screw it, I am that weird. It's almost like American society has been deliberately set up that way, not by individuals, but by forces, to prevent people from manifesting like the truer version of themselves or a better version of themselves, for reasons that I think are like intrinsically weird. But like, it scares me and it worries me and it makes me very sad.
How do you reconcile, there's two separate paths I want to go down here. How do you reconcile, and maybe I'm making a value judgment with the statement that I shouldn't be, but this movement towards complexity, is it neutral or does it have a beneficial or optimal state in terms of the role of the individual? And how would you reconcile that with what you're saying about the forces that have shaped America and some of the downsides or shortcomings that prevent us from operating optimally as the individual?
Yeah, I think one of the things you said is interesting. Is like, I don't really want to make a value judgment here. And I'm like, nah, man, make value judgments, right? Like, one of our big problems as a society, particularly postmodernism, is that we're unafraid to make value judgments, right? But one thing that Brett told me, I was like, we were chatting and I was like, dude, how do you get people into this, right? Like, what's the way in? And, you know, one of the things he said, which was that, like, this theory of complexity came out of cognitive science. Do you know why it came out of cognitive science? Because often that's concerned with pathology, right? And where people go really wrong mentally. And what they've discovered is that this sort of path of complexity, this hero's journey that people go on, is optimal. People are like, people have optimal lives when they operate that way. And what else do we care about other than living an optimal life, like being perfectly psychologically balanced, right? And it turns out that following this kind of path and this kind of pattern just works out really, really well. Does it work out really, really well physically? I have no idea, but I know it works out really, really well mentally and physiologically. People who adopt this kind of lifestyle just do incredibly well as individuals, and they're great fun to speak to, and they have really cool lives. And so that's what interests me. And it's like, is that a value judgment? Like, it's not really provable, right? There aren't really studies to prove that, but like, It seems to me that like, when you dig into anyone's lives, I mean, I'll give you like a tangible example. David Senra, the guy that runs the Founders podcast, he studied like 220 people, right? And like, he's like, almost all of them have horrible lives, right? These are the greatest people we've ever known. But he's like, Enzo Ferrari had a horrifyingly bad relationship with his family. He never got on an elevator. He never got on a plane because he was so anxious, right? Like, these guys are held up as titans, but they have not lived what we would consider to be great lives in a lot of cases. And he's like, and then there's Ed Thorpe, this guy that founded the first quant hedge fund and like broke roulette in Vegas. And you listen to this guy's life and it's like a thriller. But, you know, David is also like, I met this guy at 90 and he looks fitter than he did at 60. And he's really energized. And you listen to this podcast and you're like, this guy just followed his curiosity all his whole life. Yeah, he became fabulously wealthy. Where's the causality there? But you realize that he was able. One of the things Brett talks about that I think is really important to this whole conversation is one of the greatest causes of psychopathology is an inability to correct your errors, right? So it's like, I get stuck in a dead-end job. You've got to correct that error. You know you've made a mistake, but you don't correct it because of all the things preventing you from correcting that error. And it's like, if you get stuck on a path that isn't right, like, you know, Thorpe ends up in all these areas where he's like, okay, this well has kind of run dry, and then I've got to correct that error and go back down the slope of the fitness landscape and end up somewhere else. And your ability to be flexible with the way that you approach that is really, really important. But again, I'm not sure these are ever going to be more than just anecdotes.
The other question I wanted to circle back to is the idea that everyone has a thing that they can do that the system values is neat. It sounds too pretty, like to be true. And yet everyone loves the idea of ikigai and being able to find, you know, that place you sit in the middle that combines your interests and what the world will pay you for, etc. Is that a real practical thing for everyone? And maybe you could look at it in two senses. One is, maybe we shouldn't expect that everyone finds a scenario like you have, where you've been paid to literally be you, and you've converged or collapsed the ideas of value creation and value capture, if you will, versus maybe some other people they have to be a janitor, but maybe they can find some niche on the internet where they deliver value to other people. Just trying to understand how we should think about this idea that there is an opportunity for us to live optimally and in a way that the system values highly.
Yeah, man, I just wish I could give a good answer to that, because I think about it all the time. There's a fundamentally elitist angle to it, right? Which is like, some people just have to pay the bills, and there is a certain level of income which you have to get to. And then you get back to the problem of, does the universe care about my wallet, right? Like does it really care enough that if I follow my list, will those doors open? Or you have the even more nihilistic angle that maybe some people are just useless, right? And I think a lot of people in their heart of hearts believe that they're either too dumb or, you know, too poor or whatever it is. That just hits me too hard. Like, I refuse to deny any individual human being intrinsic value. But there's maybe a different way of framing it, which is that we don't come out of the womb with a skill set that's valuable. You know, even Joseph Campbell is, first you earn the rules and then you break the rules and then you follow your bliss, right? Like, you know, the martial artist learns to get to a point where they have like black belt like skills, right? Where they become that sage. So there are certain skills that are worth cultivating. And so I think you have this angle where, like, maybe you have an apprenticeship. And I think the American society is not set up for people to follow their bliss, not set up for everyone to follow their bliss. And that is just a structural problem. I wish we were all in Dunbar's number of 150 people in a much simpler world where everything was great. The flip side would be that if you're in the internet of 8 billion people, it's easier for you to find that niche. I just don't know how to reconcile that with, like, my belief that everyone is curious. They may not have a gift to go with that curiosity yet, but they can probably cultivate it over time if they work on the right things. But yeah, it's like, as you can tell, I'm kind of all over the place on this, because I just don't really know what the right answer is. I think something economically is that I get into a lot of arguments with older people about this, which is that a fry cook at Taco Bell, right? You're like, are they following their bliss, right? Like, the janitor. And I think that part of the reason that American society is problematic is that there's no social mobility anymore. That maybe you spend 15 to 20 years as the fry cook, and then you know you get the mobility to become the manager. And then once you've got the manager, you've individuated to such an extent that at 25 or 35 or 45, you have enough. And then you can transcend into the second half of life where you get to talk about this. And in many ways, that kind of puts a bow on what I want to say, which is that if you don't care about any of the stuff that I'm saying, I don't care, right? I think there's a cohort of people that are in the stasis stage of the hero's journey, where they have this nagging sense that everything's not right. I want to talk to them. I want to talk to stuck middle-aged men, right? Predominantly, because that's the cohort that I understand, because that's the story that I lived. I think there's a lot of them. I think it's a lot of them. And I think that often when they're in high-income professions, they get even less compassion, because people are like, how can you be unhappy? You're rich, right? Or you have enough wealth. And they just don't understand that. But often people get themselves into bad psychological situations because they feel that should be true of themselves. So it's like, cool, the world's a big place, and maybe this thesis doesn't apply to a lot of people, but I know it applies to that community, and that's the community that I want to speak to first.
And I think as well that demographic has developed a skill set, and in some cases a network that could be leveraged to have outsized returns on the rest of the network. To zoom out on this theory of, and I know we're jumping around all over the place because there's so many interesting threads to pull in here. One of the questions I had as I was going through Brett's work is, we still have the question of kind of the source of this process, of this underlying process. Through human history, we've said, you know, there is this omniscient, omnipotent being that kind of controls or guides this thing. Maybe more recently in human history, we've said that it is it's without a guide. Is it just processes all the way down, or like, what do you think is underlying this thing or guiding this, if there is one?
Well, the idea is that, like, there's all these weird things that I've never really understood for a while, which is like the internet coming to know itself, right? So as you get more conscious, the internet can know itself better through you, which is always something that takes me like 20 minutes of thinking to work out what the hell that mm-hmm. means, right? But it's sort of like, well, maybe that's what we're going back to, a state of like a totally unified consciousness where you and I get models of the world that are so sage-like, we can move with great efficiency and meaning and everything's fantastic, but we're not going to get there in our own lifetimes. It's just the direction of travel is to get back to that point. And maybe at that point, everything ends and the game's over, right? Like, who knows? I mean, for me, I don't care, right? That I feel that like it probably is processes all the way down, because otherwise, like, everything we've ever seen is a process, right? Like, when it's just a question of how fast it's moving. And mm-hmm. with all of these questions, I've now learned, in kind of paring away my life to focus only on the stuff that I'm really interested in, I have to ask myself with every conversation, I'm like, all right, how will knowing the answer to this help me live in the world? How will it help the process, right? And at the moment, me knowing the ultimate source of this process actually doesn't help me in any way. What I'm interested in is how do I live the process, which really helps me because it feels amazing when you do it.
As I was preparing for this interview and I drafted that question, I was like, at the end of the day, I'm not sure it practically matters. It's more about figuring out how to be an optimal individual within this complex system. Your explanation of kind of this collective consciousness reminds me of, and I haven't revisited this book in a while, so I'll probably butcher the premise, but Scott Adams, the Dilbert writer, had this book called God's Debris. Would highly recommend. Sounds like you've already checked it out. But I found a lot of similarities between this like unifying theory and what he described there, which was almost like, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, I think the plot was basically that God kind of disbanded itself, and then it was the universe's kind of responsibility, if you will, or goal to reassemble, to kind of pull back together the consciousness of God. And so it was like this movement again towards ever increasingly complexity that resulted in that unification again. Is there anything else as a part of this theory that you think is important for individuals to understand that highlights a really critical element of this that you think it's worth expanding on for folks?
Yeah, I think the end goal of all of this is what I've seen referred to as the flip. And the flip is basically, we have this incredible analytical intelligence in our brain's left hemisphere that allows us to be highly intellectual, highly verbal, highly articulate, speak with great syntax, conduct the world's greatest scientific discoveries, reduce the universe down to the Higgs boson, right? It tears things into pieces and analyzes them and does an unbelievable job at that. But it also takes things out of context, and it makes single point interventions in systems that end up destroying entire ecosystems. And this is the story of the last 200 years, where we've gone dramatically into our left hemisphere, and that's created epidemics of autism and schizophrenia, according to McGilchrist. But it's also led to us creating grid-like cities, destroying nature, destroying our environment, and just becoming increasingly reliant on digital abstractions. Things that aren't actually real and don't have any nutrition baked into them. And so you have this structural problem, and the flip is basically a rebalancing back to the right hemisphere. And I think with them both in union, but the right hemisphere has always had a duty of care over the left, and the left has always been competitive to the right. And that dynamic is always incredibly interesting, particularly as the right hemisphere is largely mute. So we experience it as a voice of conscience or us telling not to do something. But when I think about how anyone's life goes well, it's typically through giving much higher weight to external feedback than to their own intellect. That if they attribute intelligence to their environment, which I appreciate is just a wild thing to say in today's world, but a synchronicity, for example, where when you're on your beam, when you're engaged in a positive sum game, you'll get a synchronicity, which is a meaningful coincidence. And some people will even say that meaningful coincidences are not a thing. It's just all pattern matching in your brain, to which I call aggressive bullshit. You just know when you see them. right? That you know that that's a more meaningful coincidence. And you can obliterate one, but you can't obliterate five in the space of 4 hours, right? And you get more and more and more the more you're going in the right direction. That is an example of your environment signaling back to you that you're moving in the right direction. And having faith in those external cues prevents you from getting to a point where your ego cannot go anymore and you cannot grow anymore. And you're a closed system that ends up just dying. That you can push beyond those barriers and kind of integrate those anomalies if you're willing to give your environment a lot more credit. That it isn't just a dead Newtonian box of stuff to be manipulated, that you can actually enter into relationship with the world around you. How you do that is a much longer discussion, but just starting to understand that you're being given cues, and if you pay attention, you can receive them and follow them. It sounds like mystical woo-woo, to which I would just say, try it.
Are those external cues... So normally I think, in going back to the left and right hemispheres, we think in terms of logic and emotion. Are these external cues something entirely separate, or would you liken them more to, is it what we've maybe misattributed intuition to?
I think you can simplify it and just say energy, right? Like one of the metaphors I like is that if you put a bacteria in a sugar solution, it will learn to swim towards the sugar solution, because the bacteria that doesn't do that doesn't last very long, right? And we are fine thinking about the world in those terms when it comes to food. But I think if the whole world is made up of information, which it very obviously is, not all information is equal. And some information has a higher energetic signature to it. And we know that's the case because some things feel better to consume. Some things feel meaningful. And the distinction I make there is you feel better after you've consumed it, right? It's not a hamburger, right? So it's like, wow, I just had an hour with Spencer and it was just phenomenal. I'm so energized. Like, he's just such a great guy. I want to meet him again, right? You go on a date with someone, you come out afterwards and you're walking on air. I want to see that person again. And I can't wait till I see that person again, relative to a meeting that you have. And you're like, and it's kind of fine. There are these experiences I have with books. I'm having one at the moment where you open the book and you're tearing through it and you can't explain why. It's not even like super crazy interesting to you, but you might find out 2 years later why you were tearing through that book. And I think trusting that, you don't have to believe in anything as woo-woo as synchronicities. I just think you have to be really disciplined with the way that you deal with the energetic signature of everything that you consume.
I like that. Well, we're butting up against time here. In closing, I always like to ask the same question, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
What question do you need to know the answer to, where you believe that answer will also help other people?
That's great. Awesome. Well, Tom, thank you so much. Definitely going to be having you back on. Cool. This was a blast. We were talking about deriving energy from a conversation or interaction. I definitely have that right now. It was like I just had a cup of coffee. So appreciate that.
Thanks, mate.